You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Rick, if I do this entire interview with a halo over my head, will you object? Look at that.
No, that's actually perfect.
That's really good.
It goes with your it goes with your theme there.
I'm going to back away off that, I think.
I am Rick Kleffel, host of Narrative Species.
Joining me is
Scott Guild. He's the author of Plastic and also the album Plastic and his band Open for Blondie. All hail Scott Hill. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. I don't think I've ever received an all hail in an interview before, so that's a wonderful first.
Well, opening for Blondie is definitely a reason for such. This is a wonderful novel. It just kind of blew me away. I was, on one hand, I was expecting, as I started and kind of looked, you know, at the cover and kind of tried to grok what it was without actually reading it, as one does. I was thinking, you know, way over the top kind of satire with plastic people. And as I got, and it kind of starts to seem that way at first, but then as I got further and further into it, it has so much heart, so much emotion, so much feeling for the characters. It's really, you get partway through, you think, this is a really beautiful novel that speaks directly to so many aspects of our existence right now. So my question is for you, my first question is, did you design the world and then bring the characters into the world and see where they went? Or did you design the characters and create the world around the characters?
Definitely the latter. Before the world of the book was plastic, before any of that was happening, I think I struggled for years to really find my main character. And once Erin came into shape and I understood what she was struggling with and the tensions in her life, it still took a little while before the plastic world kind of emerges. But it was almost step by step, finding Erin, getting deep into her emotions, her family stuff, the fact that she was grieving her father and had estrangement from her sister. And then once that emotional core was kind of in place, then all of a sudden this plastic world sort of bloomed around her. So I am so glad to hear what you're saying about the book, because that's definitely what I'm going for, is the type of feeling where you have a heartfelt book, a book about a character struggling with real human things, things grounded in family and personal growth and spirituality, but in this surreal space that feels to me like what our world feels like right now, right? You know, it's set in the future, but I absolutely feel like I'm in a world of plastic figurines at the moment. It sounds like you do too.
I think the virtues of this kind of fiction is that you're it allows you to use the science fiction and all the weird parts, the imaginary aspects to emphasize and, you know, talk about things that straight, if you do it as a straight up book, either come off as maybe boring or dull, but more importantly, to exaggerate, use them to exaggerate, to take the internal things out and say, here it is.
Right. Yes. And I think something, I feel like one of the things I'm excited about in contemporary literature now is the way those two 20th century strands of really heartfelt realist fiction that you get with Marilynne Robinson and people I adore like that, and the kind of wackier John Barth, Thomas Pynchon type of fiction, it feels like those sensibilities have really merged in a lot of contemporary fiction in some ways, where you can have all that metafictional stuff, but it's not just zany and it's not just satire. And I do think it's a testament to the way the internet has changed our lives and how bizarre the current moment we're living in is that you can mash together heartfelt, sentimental emotion and all the stuff that realist fiction is really designed to dig into and put it in a Thomas Pynchon space, and it doesn't feel weird anymore. I think our lives. So, good for fiction, probably bad for our souls, you know?
Yes. You know, so talk about one of the things that I found as I read this book, and as I read other books I really like, is I find myself, if there's a tweak in the language or something, you'll find yourself in your everyday life thinking in the language of the book or seeing things through the lens of the book. And in this book, everybody speaks in a very simplified, it's like, you know, a texting. Dictation. So talk about creating that texting dictation so that it enjoys the, you are able to convey your everyday content, but also you want to grab readers and bring them into your world by force of language.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. So you felt, you know, as you were reading the book, and I have heard this from a few other people, that you started thinking a little bit more in those terms. Were you ever saying to people, I go get food now, or I need...
You want
water or things? Rewiring your brain a little bit. Yeah. How can I put this? The book didn't kind of, as I was saying before, the book didn't arrive to me like as a piece. There was a lot of finding what worked and what made sense. And, you know, a lot of these things are intuitive. Something clicks and you like it. So I started writing the dialogue that way at a certain point. And it was very fun and very funny, and, you know, it's very satirical in a way, because it's taking the way we currently text to each other, pushing that a little bit farther, and then everyone talks to each other that way. But then I spent years with the characters talking to each other that way and going through the deepest emotional stuff in their lives, talking in that kind of clipped language. So I feel like I made this discovery that language is so much more powerful than even we give it credit for, because I didn't feel by the end of working on the book that I was leaving much emotional content out of their lives or their ability to express each other, even with the language that clipped and that shrunk down. It still managed to find a way to address those things. So I don't know if I would have stuck with it if after a few years of working on the book, I wasn't able to go to deeper emotional spaces in that language. So it began as satire, but by the end, I didn't see anything strange about it. And then I would give it to people to read, and they mentioned how odd the dialogue was and how satirical. I was like, oh, that's right, of course. Yeah, it is. It did start that way. But by the end, when she's grieving her father in that language and going to funerals and offering condolences in that language, it all just felt very sincere to me. So I think it did inset my brain. And I would talk that way sometimes to people and freak them out, definitely. Yeah. you can't write a weird book without getting a little weird yourself, or, you know, or it's a chicken and the egg thing. Maybe you're weird, and then the book, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Now, you're a musician. You opened for Blondie All Hail. Did the book was? And I've heard some of the music from the book, and it's beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah,
it's kind of shockingly normal. I mean, in that, you know, I was thinking maybe something like old pre-pop Human League, where there's all sorts of treatments on the voices and things are really weird and kind of mechanical. But this is just straightforward, beautiful kind of music, pop music. Was the music written before the book, after the book, during the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I, sorry, there's a siren going by or something. As I was writing it, one of the things I loved was Aaron is obsessed with this TV show called Nuclear Family. And that TV show is a musical where the characters break into song and sing. And, you know, there's the dancing Christ figure who comes off the cross, Morris, and does his song and dance and so forth. So at a certain point, Aaron started wanting to I talk about these characters like they're real people, but Aaron started breaking into songs and spotlights would shine down on her. So it was kind of when the book was finished, I had the thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if these songs were fully built out into real actual music you could connect to and put on? And, you know, then the idea came of, let's structure the album according to the storyline so you could listen through the album and it would take you right through the story of the book. So that became a real joy to work on. And I collaborated with one of my favorite musicians, this artist, Johnny Rogers, who goes as Cinder Talk, and the singer Stranger Cat, Cat Martino, who's brilliant and has just collaborated with everyone. So yeah, I was very lucky to have this wonderful team of musicians I got to work with, or these two incredible musicians. And Kat is down in Miami, Florida. Johnny's over in Portland, Oregon. And I was in Nebraska and then Indiana, where, you know, the academic job market was taking me. So it was all very, you know, postmodern, the way it was, files flying across the country to put it all together. But you're right. I feel like the music comes from, when you were saying that, I was like, you're right. It's not, the music doesn't go into that strange, zany place that some of the world building in the book does. And it feels the music is almost Erin's deepest heart. It's almost like her, when she's talking in monologue to the camera in the book and you're hearing her deepest thing, it feels like the music exists there a little bit more, because it is just, the music is trying to be her raw emotions and so forth. But we did play with a few zanier tracks, and it just never felt right. It never felt like it was really getting at the core of what she was going through. But that's really insightful that you noted that.
You know, one of the things that I loved about this book was that story, the show within the show. And also, too, let's take one thing right out of the box, mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. from the beginning, and it took me a while to grok this, that you yourself are in the book as the omniscient third-person narrator for the parts that aren't about the show within the book, The Nuclear mm-hmm. Family, that also has its own kind of omniscient right. or new third-person narrator, who's Erin yeah. or who's ever watching
yeah.
the show.
Yeah.
Talk about the decision to write this, tell the story as it would be told in a sort of screenplay, more of right. a treatment than a screenplay, but
right.
you would know.
Right. Yeah, the decision to have the third person narrator almost be a camera a lot of the times.
Right.
Yeah. It's a really interesting thing, the way form works in fiction, right? Where the way you tell the story, you want that to click so deeply into the emotional reality of the character. And there was something about how alienated she felt and how Erin had veered from the traumas of her life into technology, virtual technology, and also just into media and becoming obsessed with a TV show and writing lots of fan fiction in her head and things like that. That writing it in a traditional third person narrative mode, I mean, I did try that a whole bunch, because that was just sort of the standard way I started out. It never felt quite right. It never felt quite connected to the reality she was actually living. So as I tried different things through the years, that camera technique was the one that resonated the most, that just felt the most connected to her own inner emotional life. And I think there's just also something wild when you're creating a story and you're telling a story and you're thinking, how can I make it feel like this moment? How can it have the texture of what life feels like this moment, where we're all so digital and we're all filming each other all the time and we're all on camera all the time? You, when you just are trying out lots of different techniques, I have so many failed ideas that will never see the light of day, but certain ones click and certain ones make sense. And that was one of the ones that, once I locked into telling the story that way, it really gelled. And it felt like it let me explore the emotional texture of being alive right now, which I find very strange. But I love the way you started out our discussion saying that it didn't feel cynical or just satirical to you, like just like I'm poking fun at it. I'm actually rereading one of my favorite books right now called The Loved One by Evelyn Waugh. Have you ever read that book?
Oh, absolutely. What a magnificent writer and novel.
That novel is so good, but it could not be angrier. It could not be more, look at this horrific modern contemporary American society, post-World War II society. And even the British guy who comes over and experiences America, who's not quite as corrupted by it all, he's also just like the worst human being. So I don't think of Plastic as an angry book in its satire. I think of it, I don't know if everyone would share this view, I think of it as a hopeful book, a book that shows our humanity can sort of bust through, in our souls and the light inside us can bust through really anything, any structures we create that try to oppress that. That's how I feel about the book. But it's It's an interesting thing, because to really capture what this moment feels like, there is kind of an Orwellian vibe to our moment, isn't there? Or there is kind of a vibe of, you know, maybe it won't feel this way in four more years for various political reasons. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole, but but it's a strange moment for sure. Yeah. I don't know if the election had gone a different way. I don't know if you've been saying how much my book captures this moment, but it feels very current to me right now, for sure.
Well, one of the things you said really struck me.
Yeah.
Was that you said you felt like Aaron was real to you.
Oh, yeah. Maybe too real.
When I was a little kid, like probably 5 or 6, I used to go, my parents would go out to dinner and they'd take me to my grandma's house to be babysat. And my grandmother and my aunt lived together, and they would talk about the people on the TV like they were real people. And they would watch soap operas.
And soap operas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This was back in the 60s. So, it took me a while to figure out who they were talking about. And you know,
you thought they were their friends.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I was just a kid, and then I realized I had this moment of realization. Wow, they're talking about the people on the TV like they're real. And so that kind of reality has been with us for quite some while. And I think that one of the things this book does very well is capture that feeling that, you know, the remote is real. I mean, you are in fact a real human being sitting in a real
Me?
Room. Yes.
I don't know about that anymore. Maybe not. Jury's out if I'm real. I don't know.
but you know, I obviously at this point, you know, heck, you might be an excellent simulation if you are. Good job programming.
Right.
So talk about that. I think goes to the feeling of real emotions that we have towards these characters and your ability to create them. And one of the things I think you do well in this book is to build up to those moments. So when the emotional revelations come, we're ready for them. And so talk about, you know, you must have done some extensive rewriting, it sounds like, to create that kind of emotional experience arc for the novel.
And I'm just curious. So when you're talking about the emotional arcs in the book and the creation of them, is there a specific emotional arc you have in mind, like,
well,
with Aaron?
I'm just thinking of, like, when Aaron, you know, in some of those monologues, where when she first starts talking about, especially, I think, her relationship with her sister.
So how that builds, right?
Yeah. So talk about, you know, how did you create those arcs? Was it deliberate? What did it come out in rewriting?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You never want to. It's a real question, because you never want to play coy with the reader, where you feel like you're holding back important information from the reader just to get a little like dazzle and pop of surprise on them, because that can create a distance from the main character. So the fact that we start out the book, there's mentions of a problem with Aaron's sister Fiona. There's mentions of something going on there, but you don't really find out the full story for a little while. You know, my fear was that it would feel like, well, of course, Aaron would be thinking about this all the time. And if we don't tell the reader that information, we're not getting the full picture of Aaron's emotional life. The way I ultimately felt, and I'm so grateful, actually, and glad to hear you mention her sister in context of revealing emotional realities in the book slowly, is that Aaron is living at such a distance from that and trying so hard not to think about it all the time, that when the events in the book, you know, her falling in love with someone else, her dealing more directly with her trauma, her, you know, just all the things that happen in the book that make her confront herself. When she's finally able to think about her sister in a fuller way because of what's happening in the book, that's when the reader gets that information. And that did feel like the right way to structure it emotionally, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, so if you have a character who's suppressing some information in their lives, but they're growing and changing and their spirits kind of evolving throughout the, as the story goes along, then yeah, that can be a good time for the reader to get that information. I think I just believe strongly when someone's reading, when I'm presenting a character to the reader, I want the reader to almost feel like they can slip inside their skin. In this case, you know, plastic skin, but still like feel like you can really get inside the character's body and everything. So that was an interesting thing in the book as well, because our emotions live in our body so much. And so much of the fiction I love is constantly describing physical sensations that characters are having as they have different emotions. And I think that kind of sensory physical description is one of the main ways that we live inside characters and know characters. When you read about descriptions of a body, it lights up something in your brain and you feel it sympathetically in your own body. And you're reading a book, but the way language acts on the brain, you're actually having, more often probably than you realize, a full body experience of what you're reading. You know, language is probably more advanced and futuristic than we give it, because it's like the oldest, you know, technology or whatever. But here I am writing about plastic people and everybody's being filmed by a camera. So the squeaking of the hinges and all those different little plastic moments with the bodies kind of had to stand in for that. And the fact that it is describing the body, but in that queasy plastic way, that was a goal, you know, that I had of creating the same sort of feeling on your body, but in a sort of warped way that technology makes me feel right now. You know, like every time I pick up my smartphone, you know, it's like, crank. That was a long ramble. Please ask another question. I'm sorry.
No, that
you're
was
you're
great.
Asking great questions, so I go off on these long riffs, you know.
Well, you know, also one of the things I thought was interesting about this book is, since at its core it's really about grief, and yeah. You were talking about that this book isn't angry, but anger is the flip side of grief. When people mm-hmm. are grieving, they are actually also really furious.
One of the first stages of grief, for sure.
One of the things that you do really well in this book is use the anger and the anger at the world, at the way the world exists, and, you know, with your sarcastic, you know, inventions to create this deep sense of
grief. It is angry. The book is angry in some ways. You're right. I can try to hide from that and sound fancy, but you're right.
I think that it's not it's not the same kind of anger you might find in Mad Magazine, but
right.
But rather,
that's the anger I'm going for right behind me. You know,
yeah.
Guernica. You know, that's a very angry painting, but it's very, you know, it's not Mad Magazine.
No. Although they might have tried to buy it if they would have had a chance.
Well, Alfred E. Newman in the center of Guernica, that wouldn't be appropriate.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, balancing your sense of anger at the world, at, you know, the current world we live in, and using that to fuel your grief for the world that we could have.
Yeah.
And creating that kind of tension in your novel between the world that they live in, the world they could have, and the world that there is right there.
Yeah. Because I don't think of anger as always bad, or do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. When I think about the anger in the book, it's largely at our treatment of the environment and the incredible short-sightedness of our ecological policies and the way we're handling fossil fuels right now and all the different things that go into destroying our world, which is, you know, it's horrific. And I feel like in 7 or 8 generations, they're going to look back at us at this moment and just be like, oh my gosh, the level of stupidity, the level of selfishness, the level of greed, the level of short-sightedness. And if you can see that in this moment and feel so powerless against that, there is a kind of anger there. So I think a lot of the anger in the book is in that terrorist movement, that kind of grassroots terrorist movement that grows up around the inaction around ecological policy. And you know, I think that could happen. I don't see any reason why that level of anger couldn't, you know, burst forth into a very violent social movement. And then you're dealing with that kind of anger and violence that takes on a life of its own. And so you see in the book, I try to address that. And some of my favorite responses to the book I've seen and reviews of the books I've seen sort of discuss how that terrorist movement is treated. Did I slight that terrorist movement too much, or did I try to paint it as too ineffective? Would we be right just to go into that kind of violence? And I think that's such an open question. How do you respond when you actively see the future of all generations on the planet being kind of doomed and condemned? And, you know, I think some people would feel violence is completely moral and acceptable in response to that. And I think I feel an anger in response to that. And I can understand how violence could come out of that. I myself am like against violence, right? But also, you know, am I against that the Civil War happened to end slavery? You know, no. So, you know, the book is trying to tangle with that and again, in capturing this moment, sort of put that in the reader's life as fully as I know how to and capture all the different dynamics and tensions there. But there is a kind of, in addition to the anger, you know, there is grief. Yeah. And I think you very astutely point out how maybe grief comes first as the most, you grieve that our species would do this to itself. And then an anger rises out of that grief. But maybe the fundamental thing there is sadness. And maybe the sadness is the bigger thing to capture. Yeah.
Well, I must say you're an optimist to think that we'll still be around 6 or 7 generations from now to look back.
Rick, no.
Our stupidity.
You're not even going to give a 6 generation. You know, a generation is only like 15 years. You think it's that bad?
In my lifetime, things have gotten like bad so fast. You know, I have many friends who are physicists, and they will tell you that, you know, there's force multipliers and increased, you know, wobble at the edge of the probability grid, and things will get,
wobble is never the verb you want to hear in context of the planet's future, you know.
No, now
I'm sorry to laugh. I'm sorry to, you know.
Well, one of the things I think too, that I really loved about the eco-terrorists were that, not to put too fine a point on it, we haven't, Americans just live in this incredibly protected world where we don't have this kind of like violence inflicted upon us. You know, I guess the school shootings are the first symptoms of that.
There's a lot of violence around, but a lot of people can go through their lives without experiencing it too personally, viscerally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that the eco terrorist and just the idea, you know, of thing, you know, the oceans rising, et cetera, et cetera. You did a great job of putting that in perspective, in the perspective that, you know, an everyday suburban might have, which is, well, the oceans aren't near me, but, you know, the people who want to blow themselves up in because of what we're doing may actually be my neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot about what happened in the 60s in connection with the draft, you know, where because there was the draft for the Vietnam War, people felt personally that the violence was impacting them because they would see people they knew, people they loved. Nearly everyone knew at least someone who was going over there and fighting and experiencing that violence. And suddenly there's this conflagration in the culture. So you do think if it had few generations removed where, you know, we see it happening more and more all the time, but it, from everything you're saying and from what I know, it seems like the dial is being turned up all the time on how the violence that we're going to experience is actually just violence that the planet is doing to us, responding to what we've done, because what we're doing is not a balanced way to exist in an ecosystem, and the ecosystem responds. So it is an interesting thing that once the violence gets personal, and once people feel personally threatened, there's all sorts of extreme response. But you're so right that the way we live at this moment, we're still insulated enough that you're not seeing things, you know, ripping out of the framework, you know, falling apart around us or something like that. Yeah.
One of the things I loved about the nuclear family sections of this book was when you first encounter them, they're about as weird as the actual narrative. And then you get, you know, President Laughlin.
Right.
And you go, okay, well, this is really, really, really weird. But I have to thank you for putting a scene in here that is straight out of a movie that terrorized me probably, boy, I would have been about 8 or 9, when I watched it on TV, called Panic in the Year Zero, which featured that traffic jam of people on the run, and it was all just stopped cars waiting for the bombs to fall.
Well, what is it called? Panic in the Year Zero?
Panic in the Year Zero. It's
I'm writing that down.
Worth seeing just in terms of historical value. It's fairly terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk about, you know, one of the things that, you know, we all thought was gone, or I thought was gone back in the 80s or 90s, was, you know, the threat of a nuclear war. I remember, you know, as a kid, you know, fallout, the sirens ringing out, get under your desk, cover your duck and cover drills.
You had the duck and cover.
Yeah, I'm old enough to have it ducked and covered.
I mean, I know all about what that is, but to personally experience that must be such a you're a child, you know, being told get under this desk, and you know, and we laugh at it now, like how are you going to survive in a nuclear fallout? But it was designed for the people who are right at the edge of the blast zones, where it really would help if the walls came down around you. Everyone knew that if you were too close to the blast itself, you know, bye bye. But yeah.
So talk about, you know, adding the nuclear threat that we have against ourselves to, you know, the threat we also bring on ourselves, which is, you know, our destruction of the planet. I mean, that I think is, you know, it's well timed. Unfortunately, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, because when you see autocratic movements rise up, power becomes such a zero-sum game for these folks that they have weapons available. And then you think, I don't see a lot of sophistication in the thinking that goes around their decision-making. You know, I don't think we're currently in a crisis, unless things with Russia and Ukraine really escalate in a way that I'm not foreseeing. It helps that Putin's best friend was just elected. But it doesn't help the world that happened, but maybe the threat of nuclear war is down a little, maybe. Not that those are the most mature people in the world where things are going to always be sunny. I mean, that could also, so it's scary. And I think it connects to what you were saying before about grief, that just as human beings, we have whatever the rationales behind it all, whatever the historical reasons, we have invented the means of destroying ourselves into completely obliterating our own existence. And in the midst of what we're doing right now, we're obliterating so many species all the time, you know, in ways that we don't even think about on a daily basis. So that level of destruction, you know, it brings, so much sadness and so much anger, and it goes into what this current moment feels like. So I think, as I created Erin over the years, and Erin became more and more of an open space for me to sort of see the world through her and tell a story through her that felt to me like what the world feels like right now. Nuclear weapons and the capacity they have to destroy definitely became a part of that.
Nuclear war, there goes my career. Sorry about that. Another callback from my feckless youth.
Wait, what is that from? Is that from like Dr. Strangelove or something?
Roy Lichtenstein design of a girl saying that on a t-shirt.
Oh.
I think it's another Googleable item, I'm sure.
I'm going to look that up. Oh, this is also great. Yeah. And the book I'm currently working on right now is set around like 1950, 1952. So I'm thinking a lot about that post-World War II moment where the use of atomic weapons at that moment was much more real and much more likely. In that space. In fact, it took Truman a lot of, it essentially, he didn't get reelected because of how Hardy fought MacArthur not to use those weapons in Korea in the early stages when China. I'm getting into a long historical digression, though. Let's stay.
We'll stay with the novel. And
this is why all my phone calls with friends are like 7 hours long, because I want to. Ooh, let's talk about Truman. You know, it's like no one wants to talk about Truman on this podcast, Scott.
We do, but I my radio show's an hour, so. Aaron, when it's revealed exactly why Aaron is in grief, it's a really, really powerful moment. And I'm wondering, was this moment something you encountered in the prose, in the writing, or was that there beforehand? And I'd like you to talk about, like, I guess peeling the plastic back to that core kind of human awfulness of experience. And also, too, you know, PTSD. It's, you know, put that on the grave of the 20th and the 21st century. My apologies.
You're right. You're right. And I mean, obviously, the book in many ways is about that deep sigh I just heaved, you know, in the face of all of it. One of the biggest griefs that Erin experiences in the book is the loss of her father and the home hospice care she provides for him and everything. And that was straight out of my own life. I had a parent pass away very slowly from cancer. And yeah, it felt important to Erin's character and her history and who she was as a person that she had been through something like that too. So that was something I shared very deeply with that character, or in that mysterious way that our characters are part of us, however that all works. So going through that grief with her, but in the plastic mode where it's called Brad Pitt disease, and it's you know, so there is that tension of satire and heartfelt emotion kind of pressing in there. That all made the book and everything about it feel, you know, deeply personal to me. And yeah, I mean, that was one of the things writing about that really opened up Erin's internal world to me, so that when she started grappling with larger social issues and so forth, you know, she would be emotionally responsive enough to have some nuance to her character as she faced those things. And then ultimately, in many ways to me, I feel the book is about her spiritual growth and Erin as a soul and how she relates to, you know, transcendence and larger questions of what is the ultimate, you know, grounding you can have as a human being in a world where all these things are happening. So I was very, you know, grateful is a strange word. I'm rereading The End of the Affair right now. I'm actually teaching it, the Graham Greene book. Have you ever read that? Yeah. So in any case, it starts with it starts with a little quote where it says something along the lines of, there are places in the human heart that don't yet exist yet, and suffering comes into the heart so that they can have existence, or something like that. So it's almost because Erin suffers so much that she's able to think about these larger things.
So one of the things about the book is, you know, talk about the arc of the emotions themselves, grief, and also humor, because I think you do a great job with making things that are funny, but it's not the kind of a joke humor. It's more a pleasure in the punnery, as it were.
Oh, interesting. Right. Okay. Like a sort of silliness mixed into it. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I think some of the book does feel like the laughter after a funeral or something, you know, or something I've experienced a lot through my life. And I don't know if this is just coming from a Jewish and an Irish background, where humor and a sort of grim type of humor is central to your whole identity in a way, you know, probably for historical reasons having to do with the Irish and Jewish history and so forth. But yeah, so I think there is a sense where I almost think of humor as the stage of grief or something like that, where one of the ways that we are able to cope with and understand what's going on and even gain some perspective on what's going on is through irony and things like that. So There was actually in the early years of the book a time when it was just a very grim futuristic world, and there wasn't a smile to be had in the whole novel. And I couldn't really relate to it fully or feel fully connected to the book until there was suddenly a lot of potential for comedy in it. And I think it took a while for me to find that. I mean, in a way, it was almost like I had to be able to dig into all the darker stuff and dig into the loss of her father and the estrangement in her family and the ecological crisis in a real way before the humor even was possible, which is a strange thing to think about, that you have to go into the darkness and into the pain to get the humor. But it makes sense if you think about if the humor is about those things, and if the humor is going to have any depth that really allows that kind of like deeper chuckle at what existence is, you can't sugarcoat that, or it just stays very surface and very broad in terms of the humor. Yeah. So I really appreciate you saying that, because my fear in creating the plastic world, like we talked about earlier, is that it would just seem very surface and broad and a very one note kind of satire. That's just like, look how stupid life is. Look how stupid everyone talks. And that was very much the opposite of my intention. My intention was to use humor as a way to take in everything that's being talked of in, you know, terms of grief as well.
Well, one of my favorite humorous parts of the book is Morris.
Yeah, I love Morris.
So, yeah. And you said Irish and Jewish, and I thought, okay, well, that explains Morris.
That is the right, like a crucifix, or a Jesus on the crucifix who jumps down, and his name is Morris, and he kind of talks like, I sort of think of him as he has the voice of George Burns, but of course he looks exactly like Jesus on the, you know, cross, so... Yeah, and who knows? I mean, Morris is one of the oldest things in the book. Morris I had very early, and he was just always hanging around doing stuff. And eventually he started singing and dancing, and yeah.
So
he's a friend. I wish I could write more books with Morris, but Morris doesn't feel it. You can't just throw a singing, dancing crucifix into everything you write, you know?
Well,
or I guess you could, but it might not get published. Right. Someone would stop me. I think a publishing house would intervene.
Now, when you went to the publishing house, here, did you already have the music in to hand, or?
No, that came along. I had incredible luck with my editor. My editor was this brilliant woman named Anna Kaufman, and it was initially acquired by this equally wonderful editor named Tim O'Connell. And they're the kind of editors who, you know, you have conversations with them and then you can go away for months and work and come back. And so it was a wonderful dialogue. So through the years, maybe about a year and a half, 2 years of working with Anna for the most part. And at a certain point I said, I'm thinking about songs. And she thought, you know, I'd make an album that would go along with the book. And she said, that sounds really amazing. And then I brought her a couple songs once I started working with collaborators, and you know, she told me the whole office was listening to the songs and having fun, and I was like, this is you know, it's a lucky space to be in, where Pantheon Books is they put out a lot of it. Like they put out Interior Chinatown with Charles Yu and House of Leaves and a lot of these books that are just up for trying new things and doing strange things and strange in like a good way, I would say, in a great way, you know. So I feel like I got very lucky in the sense that they were up for all that. And then they created animations with the music. They did all sorts of remarkable things. So, yeah, I love them.
I can see why.
Buy my next book.
Now, as you were writing this, did you know the whole outline of the novel, or did you discover the ending while writing it?
What part of the end? I guess we shouldn't give too many spoilers, right?
Right.
Isn't that
right.
always a
well,
thing? Right.
No. I'm quite loath to give any spoilers, but I'm just curious about, you know, was the book, did the book come to you from in a beginning to end, or just, or did you just like chisel the road as you drove down it?
I would say more the latter. And it's funny me thinking of spoilers. I'm loving talking to you about the book so much, and you have so many wonderful things you're saying. I keep forgetting this is being recorded and other people will hear it. So I don't remember, like, don't give away the entire ending, because if, you know, it would be a lot easier to talk about all this if I just did spoil the whole book. But Yeah, so the ending, the actual final chapter, I did get pretty early where that just felt right to me. Something about the way the book ended with that vast kind of conflagration or that huge eruption at the end, and then that very, the final scene where she's driving out and the graveyard and so forth. That I did have kind of early, but it's interesting. You can have that and know that's kind of the right ending, but then the road to get there can be changed many, many times. So there was a lot of revision in all that. So I wouldn't say this was one of those books where I said, "Oh yeah, I just knew I wanted it to do this," and then I wrote it out. I would feel, grateful if I ever got to write a book that way. But that's have you spoken with many writers where they just say, "Oh, I know what my book is," and they sit down and write it, and it seems amazing,
Right. Well, I mean, that makes you a pantser, as it were, as
Yes.
opposed to
Yes,
a
I would
plotter,
definitely.
an
That's
outliner.
a definitely. And I think in some ways sometimes I try to aspire to be a plotter, but then once I start writing the plot, I discover I had it all wrong once I'm actually in the scenes and the moment and everything. Because the characters want their own things, and sometimes they won't do or say what you want them to based on the plot. You're like, "Here's your lines, Aaron," and she's like, "Oh, I'm not interested. That's not what you've misunderstood this whole thing." Yeah.
Well, one of the
So.
things I like is that, or in my opinion, sometimes when the author discovers something to their surprise, it's even more surprising to the reader.
Right. That's such a great point. Yeah, that when you're having a feeling of surprise when you're reading back through what you've done, and there's a certain charge to it that you can feel on the page. Yeah, that's a very good point. But so many of the writers I love are plotters. I mean, I'm teaching a Graham Greene book right now, and from what I've read, he would just write almost exactly 500 words a day, and when he got to the end, after the end of his book, after 500 words a day every day, he'd be like, "And now here is my book." I guess for the most part. So his books are charged with surprise and twists that really work, and deep feeling. And so you don't have to be a pantser to get there, but that does seem at the moment, at least my way into trial and error is what I love in the process of craft. And yeah, maybe it's just an excuse not to go outside more. I really do like my little chamber. Yeah. My wife and I are about to have a kid, so a lot is going to have to change about my hermetic lifestyle. I'm going to have to go to the playground and interact with people. They're horrible. Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to your new novel. The
Yeah.
new novel by Scott Guild is classic. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Well, thank you, Rick, so much. This has been a pleasure, and you just brought so much insight and energy to this discussion. It's been a blast. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.